Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 20th, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on the Internet of Things. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We will hope to get to audience question and answer on this program by about the 40-minute mark. I'm pleased to welcome Kelly Donahue, a partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer, to moderate today's discussion, so I'll stop here and turn things over to her for further introductions. With that, Kelly, the floor is yours.
Great. Thanks so much, Will. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for dialing in to today's teleforum on the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things, or the IoT, is a phrase that many of us have heard tossed around in passing over the past few years, but recently it's emerged as a hot topic among leaders both in industry and in the government. Last April, the NTIA, or the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, released a request for comment seeking broad comment, broad input on the benefits and the challenges of IoT technologies and what role, if any, the U.S. government should play in this area. Over 130 responsive comments were filed last month, submitted by a broad range of stakeholders from technology companies, car manufacturers, to universities and telecom providers. What's clear from both the NTIA's request and from the comments submitted is that there are many issues at play with respect to the IoT, from spectrum availability to cybersecurity to privacy concerns surrounding the collection of massive amounts of data. What comes hand in hand with this is that there's also ample room for regulatory mischief. So we have some terrific panelists here today that will help us better understand this trillion-dollar opportunity called the Internet of Things and lead a discussion on what type of technological and policy mix is needed to ensure its success. Joining me, we have Eric Wenger, Director for Cybersecurity and Privacy on Cisco's Government Affairs team in Washington, D.C., Jamie Susskind, Legislative Counsel to U.S. Senator Deb Fischer, Senior Senator from Nebraska, and Neil Chilson, Attorney Advisor to Commissioner Maureen Olhausen at the Federal Trade Commission. Many thanks to each of you for participating in today's call. Let's just jump right in with some basic questions. My first question, what is the Internet of Things? Is it just me connected to my smartphone? Is it my smartwatch? What is it? And are there different definitions?
Sure, I can start with that. This is Eric from Cisco. So we filed comments with the Department of Commerce, NTIA, and they had asked some questions about this. And essentially what we said is that the IoT at its essence links smart objects to the Internet and to each other. And then that allows the gathering of information by sensors that enables intelligence to reach the right person or machine. And in our view, the conversation about IoT has sometimes been overly constricted by a focus on the interaction between people and sensor devices that they may be wearing, like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. And that while that's an important aspect of this, and I think Neil will probably touch upon why that is the focus of the FTC's attention to these issues, that at Cisco we believe that the full range of issues that should be inside the scope of the lens should be wider and should include the full range of network connection that involve people, processes, data, and things. And so we have at times used an alternate definition, what we call the Internet of Everything, but I think that the term hasn't really caught on, and I think the most important element of it is that the notion of the Internet of Things should be broad enough to include not just people interacting with sensor devices, but also machines talking to machines, machines talking to people, and data communicating with data.
Yeah, Eric, this is Neil. Thanks, first of all, to the Federal Society for having me on this call and to my fellow co-panelists for this discussion. And let me just say from the start that my views reflect are my own and don't necessarily reflect official policy of the Federal Trade Commission or my boss or FTC staff's views. But having said that, I think the FTC's work in this area, which has been fairly extensive, recognizes Eric's very broad definition of Internet of Things while focusing on a subset of the Internet of Things where it comes in contact with consumers. Since we are a consumer protection agency, our focus has been on the devices that consumers use and how those devices affect consumers directly. While the Internet of Things will certainly have in industrial applications, et cetera, and some of the other machine-to-machine connections that Eric was referring to, will certainly have impacts on consumers, whether it be lower cost or many other things. The FTC is focused more on the direct impacts where consumers are interacting with Internet of Things devices. So just keep that in mind as I discuss what the FTC has looked at, that we are talking about consumer-facing devices much more so. I will add just one little caveat to that is that in our comment to NTIA, which I can go into later, we did have a discussion from our competition side, our competition expertise, which is the other role that the FTC has as an antitrust agency. And we talked about some of the competitive effects of standard setting in areas such as Internet of Things. And those types of concerns would apply, or those types of analysis would apply more broadly than just consumer-facing devices. So
it sounds like Internet of Things could be sliced along two separate lines, the industrial versus the, industrial Internet of Things, machine-to-machine, commercial uses versus the consumer-facing benefits the IoT allows. But a more fundamental question, why is the IoT coming front and center now? I feel like it's a term that has been bandied about for some years, but really in the last year or so, you see it more in the media, you see it more talked about around the dinner table. Is there something specific driving that?
Yeah, this is Eric again. So I think that with every wave of technology, we have this question that comes along about whether or not we are experiencing a fundamental shift in the development of technology, or is this an evolutionary step? Is this, in some cases, even old wine in new bottles, where there's some new marketing term that's been associated with something that has been around for a significant period of time? And you know, you can make the argument that some of the elements that we're seeing here of sensors and connected devices and have been around for some time. We have physical systems that have been controlled by remote devices and sensors. But I really do think that the better argument is that this is a significant shift, and perhaps even more of a revolutionary change than the advent of cloud computing. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that we can now connect products that were designed separately, and we can even connect devices that were originally built without any capacity for connectivity. And so you can take sensors that are in very remote locations that may have been built in a different era of technology, and then add some capability to them that allows them to be remotely viewed, sensed, and even controlled over the internet. You combine that with the power of cloud computing to be able to give you that constant connectivity, the ability to pull the data, and then using the big data analytics to make decisions about what that all means. The combination of all these different things it has put us at a point where there are really dramatic changes that are taking place in our society. And then you combine that with the lower cost points and the size changes that we're able to accomplish. So we can have very, very small, very low-cost sensors that are connected constantly and have the ability to generate data that can be analyzed in brand new ways.
And this is Jamie, if I can also interject on sort of a different point. I feel like some of it is cultural. You know, obviously folks these days are sort of more comfortable with this sort of always connected mentality. You know, everybody's on Periscope or on Snapchat. You know, they're always sort of tuned in and plugged in with other people. So, you know, without sort of that level of acceptance, I feel like the Internet of Things wouldn't have taken off as it is doing now.
That's a good point. So consumers are more comfortable sharing information and using data analytics to their advantage.
Exactly.
Are there some examples that we can offer to folks on the phone of the IoT in action? Some, you know, I've heard examples ranging from connected cows to connected fridges, but you know, I think it would be fun to put some examples in play here.
Yeah, this is Jamie again. I mean, I can speak to, in Nebraska, precision agriculture is a big deal. You know, producers there are using the IoT to just better measure the things that they're, you know, doing on the farm. For example, they can measure fertilizer. They can measure the number of seeds planted. They can measure water in the soil. They can measure weather conditions, and they can sort of do that all in real time. I was recently reading an article that said that Monsanto, who's one of our producers, and then AT&T are entering into a partnership. So then, you know, Monsanto can have these real-time monitoring using GPS sensors. And so, you know, we hear from folks back in the state about how important broadband is to them and how important this connectivity is just to make their businesses more efficient. And yeah, connected cows is actually a good example.
So we also at Cisco have in the past year announced, I think, an interesting example of a project with the city of Kansas City, Missouri, and a lighting company called Sensity, General Electric, and Sprint. And we're developing a 2-mile long streetcar system that will be upgrading light poles that are along that stretch, and the light poles will now have actually a number of functions associated with them. So, in addition to giving light, which is what you'd expect from a light pole, mm-hmm. They are Wi-Fi enabled, which allows people in that area to be able to communicate using the Wi-Fi that's provided. There's information that's generated by the poles about the availability of parking spots, because the poles are outfitted in a way that they can actually detect whether or not the parking spots within their range are being occupied. They can conserve energy by ensuring that illumination is provided only when there are actually people around. And in addition, they are able to help deter crime. And so there are a number of different things we can now leverage that dumb pole to be able to do by adding connectivity to it. And in addition, we anticipate with these projects that there'll be capabilities that we can't even anticipate at the time that we're building. And so we have, in this particular example, created something called a living lab, where people in the community are able to propose ideas for how this Wi-Fi connected corridor can benefit the community.
So even just based on these few examples, it sounds like the IoT brings enormous potential and that we're just getting started and seeing what some of these benefits are. Let's talk a little bit about what role the government has played to date in the IoT space. I know, Neil, that the FTC has been somewhat of a pioneer. They've done studies and have hosted a workshop, and they, about a year ago, released a report that covers a lot of ground. What did that report say? And what do you think, in your opinion, what did it get right, and what, if anything, did it get wrong?
Sure, thank you. Yes, the FTC comes to the Internet of Things largely from its expertise in privacy and data security. We're the primary enforcer of privacy and data security laws in the U.S. and started exploring the Internet of Things with a workshop in November of 2013 and issued a report in January 2015 based on the workshop and subsequent submissions and comments and other news developments that happened. Again, we focused on consumer uses, not industrial uses. And, you know, we kicked off the report talking about the enormous potential that we've already touched on. We talked a lot about the importance of security and securing Internet of Things devices. And, you know, I think the report did five things very well, had a couple of things that I think a couple of conclusions that I don't quite agree with. And and in one part, at least, it was a bit of a missed opportunity. So let me just touch on those really quickly. The first thing it did very well is it was humble in admitting that IoT regulation, the time is not right for IoT specific regulation, at least from the FTC's perspective. And the role that we serve. This technology is very rapidly developing. We don't fully grasp how to do a sort of cost-benefit analysis, and there is some substantial risk that poorly done rules or regulations from an agency could foreclose many of the benefits. And so that was one of the benefits. You know, it prioritized the security of IoT, which I think is particularly important. We can talk a little bit about the necessity that consumers trust the technology when they decide to adopt it, and you know, a lack of security in a technology is one thing that can keep consumers from adopting it in some cases. The report recognized that there are some challenges to what we call the fair information privacy principles, which are the traditional ways that we talk about privacy or that we have talked about privacy. And two of those, at least, notice and consent about collecting information, those principles, they face some challenges, although not insurmountable, at least in the near term, from Internet of Things technologies. And so the report highlighted that. It also acknowledged that to deal with those challenges, in some areas we do use-based restrictions where you might set limits on the types of uses that people can use for data rather than limiting the collection of it up front, and those can sort of directly target the harms that we're concerned with without foreclosing the collection of very valuable information and that can really benefit consumers. It had some challenges, the report did, in that it recommended baseline privacy, which is something that some people support, some people don't. My boss has not traditionally supported that. And it talked about the importance of data minimization, which, as a private practice, you know, obviously if companies want to take on data minimization as a best practice, that's completely within their rights. As a sort of mandate or even a strong suggestion from a regulatory agency, I have some concerns that data minimization is a sort of precautionary principle approach and one that could foreclose benefits to consumers. And then I talked about the missed opportunity, and there I think there could have been a much deeper exploration of the challenges to the FIPS approach and the need to supplement that approach with use-based restrictions that are focused on consumer harm. This is something that the White House's Big Data Report looked at and the PCAF's Big Data Report both looked at and suggested that just focusing on limiting collection is not going to work particularly well in the future. It'll both underprotect consumers and possibly block innovation in some areas. And so that was a bit of a missed opportunity, and it's something I hope the FTC will take on in the future.
Eric, I'm curious to hear from the industry perspective, what was your reaction? You know, do you have thoughts on this baseline privacy or data minimization as a principle? Where is the industry coming from in terms of privacy? And I know we're skipping ahead a bit, but I'm just bouncing off of what Neil has just said.
Well, I mean, you know, The FTC recognized the importance of taking a step back from an emerging market in the report, and I think that that is an important finding in the IoT report. And at the same time, that if we in industry expect the government to take a step back and give us that space, that we have to take advantage of that by proactively thinking about privacy and security, designing, developing, maintaining our products with security and privacy in mind. Because if we don't do that, a couple things are going to happen. There are going to be harms to consumers. Those harms will likely impact the uptake and adoption of the technologies by end users, and will also invite a regulatory reaction. So we have been given some space, and that's an opportunity for us and also a challenge for industry to think about these kinds of issues on the front end. And, you know, from the standpoint of making a recommendation, it does certainly make sense to think about what data you are likely to need. If our chief privacy officer has said, I think very wisely, that if you have collections of information that are unmanaged, then they are essentially acting as a liability that's not on your balance sheet. And so, you know, you want to have a sense for what information you have, why you have it, how it's being stored, who can touch it, under what circumstances, and thinking about those things at the advanced stages of the early stages of the development of a product or service makes a lot of sense. Now, there are some elements to the combination of the Internet of Things and big data that, and I think this is where Neil was going, that may be foreclosed if we cut off the collection of data on the front end without understanding what possible results could come from that. And so, for example, you wouldn't want to have data that would allow you to cure cancer but not have the ability to get back in touch with the people who the data pertains to because you don't have the permission to do it or you don't have the information to be able to get in contact with them again. So there is a balance, certainly, but I think the overall message is that we want to think about the privacy and security implications of the development of technology at the early stages of design and development. And that if we don't, again, that consumers will not use the technologies, they'll step away from them, the market won't grow to its full potential that we project for it, and that we will invite a government reaction.
And I would have to imagine that there are different considerations at play with respect to privacy and protection of information with respect to the consumer side versus the industrial side. To go back to Jamie's example, I don't think that, you know, the farmer is going to care quite as much about the soil sensitivities and that data versus someone who's wearing a Fitbit and, you know, wants to keep the data being collected on that device from getting into, you know, the wrong hands. Is there a way to slice and dice policy along those lines?
Well, I mean, I'll add one other point here, which is that we made reference, I think, earlier to the fair information practice principles that essentially advise how information should be used. This is this idea of giving people notice and choice about how their data is going to be utilized. And those principles are still really important, but translating them to this new technology is going to be a little bit of a challenge because some of the devices don't necessarily have the kinds of interfaces that we have experienced with prior waves of technological development, where you might not have a screen or a keyboard. And as we develop the technology, we also have to be cognizant of what the expectations of end users are. I think the most important thing to think about in this development phase of the technology is not to end up with uses of information that would surprise or upset the end user consumers. And so we have to sort of take a reasonable guess about what we think that their expectations are. Fitbit, I think, is an interesting example of this, that, for instance, they have a social networking capability within the product, and so you can share information about your steps with friends and colleagues if you enable that function and then specifically allow people to see that information about you. But mm-hmm. they also have a connected scale, and they do not enable the weight information to go into that social networking thing. And I think it's because they probably correctly anticipated that if people were to accidentally share information about their weight fluctuations with their friends and family, that they might be upset about that.
Yes, I will not be stepping on a connected scale anytime too soon. But it raises a very good point on what kinds of information consumers are willing to share and are comfortable with, and goes back to the culture point of, you know, maybe we have arrived at this place where if we're walking down the street and we know that, that there are millions of devices out there gathering data on where we are at, where we're shopping. Maybe that's okay if we get some, if we get enough benefits from that, you know, discounted coupons or better traffic patterns to enable us to get to work more quickly.
Yeah. My last point here is that I was at the state AG's office in New York participating in workshops at the FTC in the late 90s about tracking of behavior online. And had we made the rules then, we would have guessed very wrong about the kinds of things that consumers would accept. And with regard to tracking their behavior, voluntarily sharing information about what they're doing, and we would not have seen, I don't think, the development of services like Facebook and Google and Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And I don't I want to come back to this point, but I'm curious to hear on the legislative front, Jamie, what has been what's been percolating up on the Hill? Are there efforts underway to increase the discussion about the IoT?
Yeah. So my boss, along with Senator Booker from New Jersey, Senator Schatz from Hawaii, and Senator Ayotte from New Hampshire, at least on the Senate side, have really tried to be involved in the conversation on the Internet of Things. So starting the beginning of last year, actually, before I came to work for the senator, she and the other three senators had a resolution that passed the Senate. And so basically what that did is it called for a national strategy to incentivize the development of the Internet of Things. By national strategy, that doesn't sort of mean a big regulatory framework. It just means that, you know, we as a country need to sort of be thinking about the next best steps that we can do to ensure that businesses in the U.S. want to be investing in this technology, and that, the regulatory conditions are favorable for them to do that. So, and then following up on that resolution earlier this year, the four senators, again, they introduced a bill called the Digit Act. So what the Digit Act would do, sort of along the lines of the resolution, it would convene a private sector and public sector working group to make recommendations to Congress dealing with various topics, you know, privacy, cybersecurity, connectivity, sort of small business uses, a lot of different things. And how we can consider those things in moving forward in the development of the IoT. It also would direct the FCC to open a notice of inquiry so private stakeholders can comment on spectrum needs to support the Internet of Things, because as all of you will know, both licensed and unlicensed spectrum are at a premium, and we need that spectrum to support the number of connected devices that are going to be coming online in the future. I can't really speak as much for the House side just because I work on the Senate side. I can say that there was a companion to the Digit Act that was introduced also earlier this year. That was Representative Paulson and Representative Welch. Our bill has been marked up and voted out of committee. Theirs has not been. And I don't know, I don't have a lot of knowledge about, like, if there's plans to do that on their side or not.
So let's talk about spectrum for a minute. I think that there are a number of challenges that the IoT faces. I think we've touched on one, privacy. Cyber is another. I'd like to speak about that in a minute. But since you raised the issue of spectrum, with all of these devices coming into play, billions of connected devices in the next, several years, obviously, we're going to need to have enough spectrum to accommodate that. What's the FCC doing on this front, and are they doing it correctly in your view?
I won't always give the FCC all the credit in the world, but I will say that the 5G rulemaking generally is viewed positively, both up here, and I've heard from industry stakeholders that's a good thing. Obviously, we need to be creative about where our spectrum is coming from, and not everybody can get sort of the mid-band spectrum. So it's good to think about, new innovative ways to do this, particularly when, you don't need, the spectrum to go across such long distances. You can have it be more point-to-point. I think that, it's a good new way to do this, and it's great that they're trying to open it up. I would like to see something more done to encourage small cell deployment, and it's something I think we've been struggling with up here. There were some bill ideas floating around, but nobody could sort of get on the same page. We understand there's some siting and zoning issues, and, you know, I mean, it's great to open up spectrum, but infrastructure is always going to be an issue, and we're sort of trying to figure out what to do with that. But I think that sort of goes hand in hand with the 5G work that the FCC has been doing. And lastly, I would be remiss if I didn't plug that the Senate Commerce Committee voted out a few months ago the Mobile Now Act, which also would adopt policies to make more spectrum commercially available, and it also would sort of try to tackle things on the infrastructure side, though I thought it could have done a little more with small cells, but like I said, that's a tricky issue.
You know, I think that this issue of spectrum is worth drilling down a little bit further on, that there actually are some needs that are associated with IoT spectrum that may be a little different than what we see in other places. And so it is possible that we need in some applications the ability to have very high speed and long distance mechanisms for transmitting data. But there are some places where we actually just need very low power devices that will. But the most important thing for them is that they are always on and that the connectivity is very reliable. And so there are some things that are maybe, you know, different about different applications of technologies. In some places you need, you know, very high speed transmissions. You need very low latency. And in other places you have things that you're the most important issue for you is that the constant availability is there, even if the range is very short.
I hate to put you on the spot, Eric, but I'm curious to if you have any examples on hand of where some applications, what some applications might be where a device would need that high speed connectivity versus the low power but always on connectivity.
So video is a place where you need a very low latency.
Mm-hmm.
But there are places where you may just need a short hop between a sensor and then a system that may then be wired that can carry the data. So if we give an example of that parking spot, right, we don't necessarily need a high-speed video image that go from the pole to the up to the network. But you may need the ability to know in very quick time and in a very reliable fashion whether or not a spot is open or whether or not there's a person in range that you need to turn the light on for. So the amount of data that gets transmitted there may be very very limited, but the availability of that spectrum has to be very high and it has to be always on.
So do you think it would be useful then for the FCC to open a rulemaking that could address IoT-specific spectrum needs head-on along the lines of what Jamie was just saying?
I think there are some unique applications of data that may be different than what we would expect from the kinds of applications that are using mobile phones and transmitting data or voice. When we're talking about sensors that are embedded, places that the spectrum needs may be slightly different, and so it may be something that we want to explore separately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, that was our hope with at least that part of the Digit Act, is that we want them to be thinking about this, and we want to be able to hear it from industry. You know, we want to be able to hear how those needs are different than they might be for everyday commercial uses. So we hope that, you know, should the bill move along, then, you know, the FCC can look into that.
Great. Well, I know we only have a few minutes before we open up the phones for questions, so I would really love to having a director of cyber on the phone here. I would love to talk about cybersecurity as it relates to the IoT, and why is it a hot topic in the context of IoT, Eric?
Well, one of the really interesting things that we have here is that because we are connecting up devices that may not have originally been designed with connectivity in mind, that you can have unintended consequences that come from interdependencies that are created. So, you know, quick example there is that when you look at the Target breach that happened a couple years back, it turns out that it was an interconnection point between the system of for electricity and heating and ventilation in a particular store, right? They had an HVAC vendor who was coming into the network in order to be able to make sure that the temperatures were being monitored properly, but their network was not properly secured. And then once that the hacker had gotten through the HVAC vendor's network into the Target network, that there wasn't a sufficient break in between the systems that were used for controlling HVAC and the networks inside the store that were used to process payment cards, which then tied back into the central payment card network for Target. And so they were able to worm their way into through a vulnerability in a small sole proprietorship HVAC vendor all the way into the central payment card system at Target. And so so we have to think about how we connect things up, what we're going to connect, whether certain things should be connected or not connected. And then even if we would decide that it's best to not connect some things up, we probably should anticipate that at some point things that we do not plan to connect right now may be connected up in the future. And so then that may seem contradictory, but we want to make conscious decisions wherever we can about connecting things up, but we should assume that things will be connected. And that means that there's, as with every network that you have to think about risk management. You have to think about allocating limited resources and prioritization. And you have to understand the maturity of your company to be able to manage these kinds of risks. Now, another interesting development with IoT is that you can have very small, because you have with the development of 3D printers and Kickstarter and things like that, you have a lot of opportunities for very small companies to develop technologies that can have a very broad reach. And so we would love if everybody who is developing technology would think about privacy and security and the implications of connecting things up on the front end. But we also recognize that if you're just trying to get a product at the door, you're focused on just the survival of your company and figuring out if there's a market for what you're doing. And so sometimes decisions that may seem innocuous at those in early stages, if the company takes off, may turn out to be a significant problem. And I think this is why it was very important. The FTC has a program called Start with Security, where they have tried to distill the learnings of 100-plus cases that relate to data and security and to turn those into very concrete lessons that can be shared with the development community. They are aiming these things at not just the companies that are developing the technologies, though, because that's a kind of a moving target, but also at the community of venture capitalists that are funding these things. And so they're going to places where the venture capitalists collect, like Austin and Seattle and Silicon Valley, and hopefully influencing the viewpoints of people who make decisions about where capital should be invested, with the goal of ensuring that we think about managing privacy and security risks early on in the development of the development of technology.
So with the FTC's program, and I'm intrigued by the idea that they're focusing on the venture capitalists, it's an interesting way to tackle this issue. Is the notion behind that venture capitalists, when doing their due diligence on a new company, they're going to look at their cyber practices, they're going to look at their design practices to see, you know, where they're sourcing their technologies from or how they're building their technologies, and if they don't see what they like, they'll take a pass on investing?
I think that's one of the ideas behind the project, but maybe Neil could speak to that a little bit more than I could.
Yes, I think that's certainly part of the goal, was to get out to audiences that, as you said, as Eric mentioned, you know, are small. They're focused on innovating, and they're focused on serving their customers and building a product. And sometimes that can mean they're just not aware of some of the developing concerns that are out there. And one of the most cost-effective things that government can do in this space is to help them avoid the problem in the first place. And one way to do that is definitely to reach out to the people who are vetting these companies for lots of different reasons, including their future risks, and make them aware that some of those risks involve risks to consumer privacy and to data security more generally, and that can help them make better decisions and help the investors make better decisions, and that pressure from investors can also help entrepreneurs make better decisions. And so we're trying to kind of channel this information through as many avenues as we can, in a way that will ultimately benefit consumers by helping companies keep their interests in mind, even their interests that aren't as explicit as, you know, oh, I have this really cool new device. So that is definitely part of the goal. And I think with the four Start With Security events that we've had so far, and with the resources that we have online, including a Start With Security report that boils down those cases into 10 concrete lessons, and then some of our other resources in our business center online. You know, we're really focused on business and consumer education, and I think it's a very cost-effective way to help address some of these concerns.
This does also highlight another point that's important for the government to focus on, which is the development of a workforce that's capable of dealing with new technologies, and also of thinking proactively about privacy and security and the development of technology. And we have a dramatic underinvestment in the education of the workforce and of teaching fundamentals of computer science and computer programming in our schools. And so this is a place that we could stand to make a significant investment.
Well, Kelly, as we continue our discussion, I would like to give the audience a chance to queue up so we can get a sense of what questions they might have. So to that end, in a moment, we will all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, again, we'll continue our discussion here. But Kelly, we do have one question on the line right now for when we reach a logical place to take that. So I will leave that up to you.
Great. Well, I think before we take a call, I want to come back to, or maybe this is a segue to the ultimate question that I think was posed by the NTIA's request, which is the role of government. I think, Eric, you touched on education. Neil, you've provided a great example with the FTC's workshops and reports that are available online. What is the ultimate role that the government can play here? Is there a role? Let's start with Jamie on, is there a role for Congress here?
Hi, thanks. I sort of like to think of our role as a goal-setting one. Certainly, I don't think it's our intention to have Congress dictating to the private sector or even dictating to the agencies, you know, how we want to proceed with the Internet of Things. You know, from our office's perspective, I think the private sector is doing a great job sort of without our meddling. But on the other hand, we do want to make sure that, you know, private sector and government are having a conversation about these big issues of importance, about, you know, privacy, about cybersecurity, about spectrum availability, about all of these things. I will say that a concern that we have that actually sort of led to the creation of our bill, the Digit Act, is that, you know, there's a lot of agencies that are operating in the space and all have, you know, sort of different interests. And we just want to make sure that they are coordinating with each other and that we're not going to end up with, you know, disparate regulations that a company, you know, maybe unbeknownst to them, is going to be subject to 40 different regulations from 40 different regulators. So we really want that dialogue to be happening and taking place. I don't know that Congress is really the one to sort of be working out the technical details, but we just want to sort of set the goals so people know, you know, these are sort of the areas we think are important for you to focus on.
I think that makes good sense, and I think especially you touch on the potential for there to be multiple conflicting regulations mm-hmm. from multiple agencies, and that's also something that the NTIA request touched upon. Is there a referee role here for any agency, or is it really should we be leaving this to the industry to sort through?
Kelly, this is Neil, and I'll touch on that just from the FTC's perspective. The FTC, as the data security and privacy regulator, I think with regard to the IoT, we're going to continue that role, and it's not a IoT-specific role. It mm-hmm. is an ongoing role, one we've been doing for quite a long time, and one big part of that is to act as a backstop for self-regulation that industry takes on. And we've already seen in IoT, we've seen several different groups get together and think hard about some of these privacy and data security issues as they apply to their particular technology. So we've had the auto manufacturers talk about and issue a set of best practices for their industry. We've had CTA issue some guiding principles on privacy and security for personal wellness data. And when companies make promises to their consumers about keeping and adhering to such principles, this is a really effective way for industry to be able to adapt and innovate while providing pretty solid protections for consumers that they can rely on. And so the FTC can act as a backstop, holding companies to their word about how they're treating consumer data, and then industry can continue to evolve and innovate in a way that ultimately benefits consumers. So that's one thing, and that's one point we made in the comment that we made to NTIA about government's role.
And I think that what Neil says is a good point. And, you know, I just think from our perspective, we just want to make sure that each agency is sort of staying in its own lane, if that makes sense. And my boss, along with the other three senators that she teams up with here on IoT issues, filed a letter in the NTIA docket sort of saying that, you know, like it's great that the FTC has sort of their expertise and, you know, we wouldn't sort of want to take that away. We just don't want everybody to decide that, you know, hey, I have expertise in data breach, so we're all going to regulate it. Because that would just be a mess and harmful for business and harmful for consumers.
Right. Eric, any thoughts from the industry perspective on where you would welcome government assistance and where you specifically would want the government to stay the heck out?
Well, and we hit upon this in the comments that we filed as well, too. You know, we emphasize the importance of interoperability and the government participating in standard setting in a way that focuses on, and this is already required by U.S. law, but focuses on voluntary consensus-based industry-led standards. We talked about already the increasing the availability of spectrum, having a little bit of a greater understanding of the different types of spectrum that may be necessary. And in addition to making more spectrum available, the whole pool of it is limited, and so we want to make sure that we use whatever is available as smartly as we can. You touched upon the idea of conflicting legal regimes, and so we may need to, in certain places, rationalize the process of deciding which laws apply and which regulations apply so that we don't have companies that are caught between conflicting legal regimes. I've heard somebody from an auto manufacturer talk about that they may be subject to one set of regulatory requirements if they were the ones to put a piece of technology into a car, but if a consumer company were to put the same device in, it might be completely different, and so that might not be rational. And then we want to promote the development of horizontal multi-stakeholder public-private partnerships to manage security risk. And so those are the places I think we think are most important. And in order for that to happen, as I mentioned before, it's really important for companies to think proactively about privacy and security so that we don't surprise the consumers with the data that's being collected or how it's used, because that will close the door on the ability for us to experiment with the development of this technology.
Fantastic. I think at this point, Will will open up for a few questions.
Great. We do have two questions on the line right now. I think we should have time to get to more than just those two if our questioners keep their questions short and to the point. So please hit star and then the pound key if you'd like to join the queue. And for now, we'll answer our two questions in the order that we received them.
This is Richard Faulkner, an attorney in Dallas, and I'm looking at this issue, and I see what Neil and Eric have said, and I would ask, in light of the FTC's actions against Wyndham Hotels for their, you know, advertising issues about security and the then consequent disputes over whether they had insurance coverage, has the industry or the government regulators been thinking about the impact of all of this on the insurance industry and whether or not consumers are going to have insurance coverage, and especially businesses will have affordable insurance coverage in case the inevitable mistakes are made?
Thanks for that question. This is Neil, and I'm not that familiar with the role that the insurance issue took in Wyndham. I was very focused on, at least in my monitoring of it, I wasn't actively involved. Very focused on the legal point about data breach and data security under Section 5 of the FTC Act. But insurance is a very powerful tool in marketplaces to mitigate risk and to address risk. And I think that's something that it is a market mechanism that can help companies deal with this when insurance markets are functioning properly. So that's about the extent of what I can say about it in cybersecurity. I know there have been developments. I know companies are offering products in this area, and it is one of the tools that companies can use to address the risks that come from living in a connected world.
I would add that in an ideal world, that the FTC would focus on situations where companies are engaged in security practices that are really so far outside the mainstream of what's acceptable that it's obvious that that they were engaging in a practice that should not be tolerated. And the question is, how would the insurance markets react to that? I think that probably what you'll see is that if that targeting is correct, if the FTC is focused in that space, then the practices that are highlighted by the by these kinds of enforcement actions will be and may have already actually been targeted by insurance companies as being something that they want to make sure is eliminated among the companies that they insure.
Thank you for those thoughtful responses. Did we have another question queued up?
We do. We will take that question now. After that, our queue will be wide open. So if at any point during this question and answer you'd like to join the line, please enter star and then the pound key.
David Emerson, Federal Society member here in Berkeley. My question really addresses on the Internet of Things. There is kind of a tension between the lifetime of products which are have embedded internet technology intentionally in this new Internet of Things versus the evolution and rapidity of the underlying internet technology itself. So, for example, let's say we have something like a refrigerator or a water heater, which may have it's a piece of capital equipment which have a lifetime of 20 years. I'd like to get the panel's thoughts on what kind of problems will we be facing and what role the government may have in addressing security vulnerabilities of a 20-year-old device with embedded internet technology, which isn't prepared, has been updated, may be unsupported for many years, and still capable of being presenting vulnerabilities, being hijacked, being turned into an army of botnets when you multiply it times the tens of millions of these types of old legacy device in the future that may inhabit the Internet.
So this is Eric from Cisco. I would say, you know, you're right on the money there, which is that we have devices that were designed without any connectivity, as I noted before, that have been added, enhanced in a way that adds connectivity to them. We have devices that are being brought on the market that are using operating systems that are supported for a year or two and then not unsupported after that. Ideally, we want to try to, and we have companies that have never been in the business of developing technology that ends up being connected to a dynamic threat environment and is consumer facing, that they may have been in consumer facing industries but not developing technology in that space, that are suddenly doing that. And so you have refrigerators and cars and airlines and that are all developing code that is used by consumers and exposed to the internet. And so these are all really interesting questions about how do we make sure that those devices are the risks associated with them are being properly managed. I think it was really interesting to look at after the Wired article with the cars being hacked, and you had different responses there where one company had to bring all the cars in and patch them manually at the dealers, another was able to patch the cars over the air at the same time that the thing was announced. And you have a debate about which one of those things is superior. The fact that you're able to update over the air means that you could do so more quickly with less friction, but at the same time, it opens another avenue for attack that must be managed as well, too. So a lot of interesting questions there that need to be worked out. And I think one of the things that we at Cisco, because we manage networks and network security, are focused on as well, is that there may be some opportunities for the network to become a little smarter and to try to fill the gaps in some places where the endpoint devices aren't capable of defending themselves because they lack computing capability or they're not being updated or the companies that create the technologies don't support them anymore.
Yeah, and this is Neil, and I would obviously echo those concerns. The security of IoT devices is something that the FTC had highlighted in its report. And the commenter's framing of it is one that we've heard in particular about low-cost devices, that low-cost devices like smart light bulbs, there may not be the same economic incentives to provide updates even sooner than, say, a connected refrigerator, which you would assume that the company would have the capital to operate for a good amount of time. One of the thoughts, and the FTC hasn't really opined on this, but one of the ways I've been thinking about this is that, similar to what Eric said about the network, many of these types of low-cost devices operate within a framework, or they operate within an application. So my smart light bulbs would be controlled by a company, and I would have an app on my phone, and they would be connected to that. And those sorts of networks have a scale at which the economic concern that those companies wouldn't have the incentive to update. Those networks probably do have that scale in many cases. And if it doesn't make sense to update a certain light bulb, those networks, one would hope, also have the capability to isolate and protect the consumer's network from vulnerabilities that may not be able to be resolved with an update. So I think there are technical fixes, or there's the possibility of technical fixes. A lot of these aren't necessarily questions that the government or at least the FTC can answer. And so I think industry is thinking about these issues, and it will be part of the value that they add, that they offer their consumers, if their products can preserve their value over time without increasing the risk to the consumer's data. So that's how I've been thinking about it anyhow.
Will, do we have time for one more question if there's one on the line?
Oh, we are all out of questions, and we are out of time as well, but if the panelists would like to linger on for a minute extra to make a closing statement, I would love to hear that.
Well, I think we have really covered the range of the benefits and the challenges that the IoT offers, and I just want to thank the panelists. I want to thank the Federalist Society for giving us this opportunity. Guys, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up? Well, thank you again. I, for one, am looking forward to the day where my connected toaster will talk to my connected fridge and make me breakfast before my self-driving car takes me to work. I can't wait for the IoT to create a brave new world for us. Thanks again to everyone for dialing in, and have a wonderful day, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.